Hi, I'm Alex Dickey.
And I'm Peter Rohde, and welcome to Terminally Quantum, recorded at the Quantum Terminal in Sydney, Australia, where we discuss everything quantum.
The Quantum Terminal is a first-of-its-kind co-working quantum hub that supports startups in quantum technology, high-performance computing, artificial intelligence, and adjacent technology companies.
TQT provides the perfect energy, convenience, and community mix to attract new networking partners in the iconic Central Station Sydney Terminal building.
Today we have a very special guest, whom is Simon Devitt. Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Yes, thanks for having me on. I'm a quantum information theorist, a physicist by training. I did my PhD down at Melbourne University at the Centre for Quantum Technology, Quantum Computing Technology at the time. And then after I did my PhD, I did what was supposed to be about a year and a half stint as a postdoc in Japan. That turned into 10 years. Where I sort of filtered through several jobs in the Japanese system, and then back in 2017 came back to Australia. Did a bit of a stint at Macquarie, and then joined the faculty at the Centre for Quantum Software and Information at UTS, which I'm now the research director.
As of very recently, and congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You wrote a very popular paper, Quantum Error Correction for Beginners, which taught many people in our field how error correction works. Could you give the elevator pitch version for non-experts on why error correction is relevant, how it's done, and what the significance of that is to the whole field?
Well, it actually, that paper turned out from a thesis chapter. So when I actually wrote out my PhD thesis, I had a chapter there that was sort of the introduction to quantum error correction as I saw it, as I was slowly learning this field. So I'm not a very strong mathematician. I'm not a particularly strong physicist, now that I think about it. But at the end of the day, it was sort of this sort of very pedantic sort of run-through of quantum error correction via examples. And then at one point I sort of had a few people look at it and we said, oh, this will make a nice review article. So we decided to write it up, called it Quantum Error. It was originally called The Idiot's Guide to Quantum Error Correction. Unfortunately, the publication who ended up publishing it didn't quite like the title. They thought there'd be copyright issues, which there probably was. And they got
probably from your co-worker, Chris Ferry.
No, not from him. I didn't know Chris at this time. I think this was before Chris even did his PhD.
Right.
This was coming from the co-authors at the time, but mostly the journal. They didn't like the idea of the title. And so we renamed it The Beginner's Guide to Quantum Error Correction. And yes, it's turned into my most highly cited article. Again, I think mainly because we certainly didn't look at it from a very rigorous mathematical framework. It was just, here's a bunch of examples. Here's how it works.
So currently we're in the very early stages of quantum computing where we don't have error correction in the quantum computers that we have. Mm-hmm. We're in this era that they call the NISQ, or Noisy Intermediate Scale Quantum Computing Era. Can you explain what NISQ is, how that is different from error-corrected quantum computing in terms of what it's capable of, and where you see its place in the world in the current NISQ environment?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who have different definitions of what NISQ is. Certainly the one I tend to attach myself to is quantum algorithms that are small enough to run faithfully on noisy hardware without error correction.
Do you want to just maybe explain what the acronym
means? The acronym?
Yes.
Also, NISQ is Noisy Intermediate Scale Quantum. So it was coined by John Preskill in his 2012 paper, if I remember correctly. And yes, it was this kind of argument of what could be done that is either scientifically or commercially interesting with quantum computers at the scale of, you know, 50 to 100, maybe 500 qubits with the current noise rates that we're seeing. And it basically comes back to this idea that error correction is a huge resource drain. Most of what an error-corrected quantum computer does is correct its own errors. So 99% of the resources are dedicated just to doing that. And as Andrew Steen, who was one of the pioneers of error correction, once reportedly quipped, is that quantum computers are error correction machines. The computation is just the byproduct. Mm-hmm. And so getting across that hurdle from the kind of chipsets that we see now to the chipsets that will do something like factoring or large-scale chemical simulations, a lot of resources are taken up by the error correction. And so the emphasis on this kind of NISQ era is, can we find something that doesn't need it at all, that can just handle the noise of these chipsets?
And briefly, what does that encompass?
Well, NISQ can encompass anything.
Okay, so what's an example of something useful that we can do with NISQ?
test NISQ.
Right.
Unfortunately. I mean, there's just a barrier that we're hitting into is that if I have error rates in my quantum chipsets on the order of 1%, okay, how many fundamental gates can I run before I'm sort of guaranteed of getting one error? If you look at IBM's latest Eagle chipsets, they're 127 qubits, if I remember correctly. So you've got one layer of gates before you're pretty much guaranteed of getting one, two, or three errors. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen with a lot of quantum algorithms is that they're extremely vulnerable to errors.
Yeah.
As soon as you, if you think of a quantum computer as the computational version of an optical interferometer, you know, anyone who's studied optics knows these things are very, very sensitive. You bump the table, somebody sneezes in its general direction and it doesn't work anymore. The same thing's true with quantum algorithms.
Yes, I think my favorite one was that people noticed in an optics lab that when the air conditioning was on in the next room, that it would suddenly change all their interference dynamics.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the dynamic that we see with quantum algorithms. Any of the ones that have been studied very rigorously in terms of its error behavior seems to show that once a couple of errors creep into your system, it just starts outputting largely random junk. So if you then think, okay, I've got 127 qubits available in the IBM Eagle system, I get one layer of gates. Okay, what can you do with one layer of gates in terms of a computation? You can't do much.
Yeah.
So many online sources have NISQ having a total addressable market share of about $5 to $10 billion. And many large companies have based their business models on the fact that non-error corrected qubits will be useful enough to be able to access this market share. How commercially usable do you think quantum computers will be during this NISQ era? Obviously, the market seems they have some use.
Well, I can't quote on the total addressable market space of what they're estimating for NISQ. But, you know, people have been looking at this now for years. People were talking when I was a grad student and Peter was a grad student back in the 2000s of what can we do with 20 or 50 qubits. It's not like this question hasn't been floating around the community. And so far, by and large, if you break it up into what is a question that you can answer that is scientifically interesting versus what is something a company or a market sector is going to pay you millions and millions of dollars to do, the second category, we haven't found really anything. The first category exists. So NISQ machines, as I said, is probably most useful for studying NISQ. It's about studying the machines themselves, about studying techniques for error mitigation, basic demonstrations of error correction. You know, the age-old question that I think is starting to become settled now, is there any fundamental physics barrier to large-scale quantum computing? We're slowly answering that question that, no, there isn't. Nothing's coming in quantum theory that's going to harpoon us. And I think at the moment that's where the most relevance is for NISQ-level investigations. Now, how much that is worth to the quantum ecosystem or people who are interested in the quantum ecosystem or the peripheral ecosystem, that's a whole different question. But in terms of, you know, HPC-level simulation capability for commercially relevant problems, NISQ does not seem to be working out.
Given that the NISQ devices, by definition, are not error-corrected, it means that there are fundamental limitations on how big they can become because the errors start growing as they pass through the system. So do you think that we're already at the point where the NISQ devices are as big as they can realistically become, or do you envisage that there are going to be further generations of NISQ devices before we hit that fundamental roadblock that the noise is just overwhelming the system and we can't get anything useful out of it?
We're at the limit given the current state of error rates within the chipsets themselves. And
right.
Where the error rates have largely been for the last decade. So if you take sort of the late 90s as being the point at which qubits were sort of first demonstrated in ion trap systems or optics or superconductors, back then they were running, depending on the system, depending on the group, anywhere between about 10% and 25% error rate. Okay, in the intervening 20 years, we've gotten from that level to building qubits that are reliably around the 1% level. So can you extend NISQ? It just depends how much you can push that down. Can we go from 1% to 0.1% physically, 0.01%, 0.001%? How many orders of magnitude can we get through better fabrication, better material science, better control? At the moment, I don't see, and I've never had any conversation with experimentalists that makes me suggest that anything less than 0.1 to 0.01 is going to be possible in the near term when it comes to hardware. Realistically speaking, most of the experimentalists, 0.1% error rates, they'll tilt their head and squint a little bit but they'll be okay with it. Factor of 10 below that, they start giggling. Factor of 10 below that, they call you an idiot and throw you out of the building.
Right.
So how much you can extend this may be a factor of 10. So maybe instead of on the Eagle chip, instead of getting one layer of gates, you can maybe get 10 layers of gates.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, you kind of touched on this before, that NIST devices, you see their greatest use is to actually test the devices and to test the technology itself, mm-hmm. To inform fault-tolerant kind of architectures. As in your current knowledge, is there something that will come in between, or have we already hit a major technological barrier that needs to be overcome before we progress towards scalable fault-tolerant devices? So I guess maybe a part of that is, you know, is 1% error good enough to actually implement error correction?
1% is on the borderline. So we're really living in that borderline territory now. And depending on the group or the company, they can leapfrog it. So we're really sitting on the line, and they're sort of going back and forth depending on the company and the experiment that you're looking at. Some are a little bit higher, some are a little bit lower. But we're definitely on that sort of 1% level on average, which is when basically the error correction becomes effective. So if you're below what we call the threshold, which is just shy of 1%, as you implement error correction, your error rates start to fall rather than go up. So if you think we're sort of at this threshold behavior now, the experimentalists really need to give us another factor of 10. They give us another factor of 10 and they do it reliably, which means if you fabricate 100 qubits and the average error rate is 0.1%, it shouldn't deviate from that 0.1% across the entire chipset. They should all be reliable. After that, it becomes a different question when you start saying, okay, can we now do large error-corrected fault-tolerant computation? Because it becomes a game of numbers. If I can do 10 of these reliably at this error rate, okay, I now need 10 million of them. So now what is the impediment to scaling to that level? Is it a function of fabrication? Is it a function of infrastructure? You know, some of these technologies that require dilution refrigeration or vacuum systems, can I scale those, you know, environmental infrastructures in the right way? And where are the bottlenecks? You know, certain systems have certain bottlenecks at certain levels. So ion traps can get a certain number of ions in a trap before you have to build a second trap. Superconductors can get a certain number of superconducting qubits into a fridge before they have to go to a second fridge. You start now hopefully accelerating until you hit these other barriers when you now have to think of other engineering solutions.
I guess the other issue is also the architectures themselves. You've talked about the error rates, but to become fault tolerant with error correction, you also need an enormous amount of interconnectivity to allow all the different components to talk to each other in arbitrary ways, because these codes correct across the entire computation. They're not restricted just to a local part of the circuit. So how much of a roadblock is that, advancing the actual structure of the architectures away from these very fixed small-scale NISC devices that we have now towards ones that have sufficient interconnectivity to enable the fault tolerance that you speak of?
Well, most of the NISC chipsets that are being developed with scalability in mind. Mm-hmm. So the fundamental designs, if you look at an IBM chip or a Google chip or INQ or whoever, they are being designed, at least on the small scale, knowing what kind of error correction we want to build. Now, there's two schools of thought here. We've got an error correction code. It is probably the most dominant when people talk about it in terms of how you're going to build an error-corrected machine. That performs well, not as well as some other error correction codes, but it's what you would call architecturally amenable. It does not have long-range connections. It does not have high connectivity between its qubits. It's got very small fixed connectivity. It's only between neighboring qubits. It makes the chipset design a hell of a lot easier. The other school of thought, but the error correction doesn't perform as well as theoretically it could if you change your error correction scheme. The other group of thought that comes out of the more theory community is we want to try to push the theory of error correction to more sophisticated codes, better performing codes, things that require less qubits to do the same thing. There's always a bit of a conservation of unpleasantness in this, is because the more that you try to squeeze out of the theoretical ability of the error correction code to correct, the less amenable it is to build it. because if you want these good performing codes, they often require long-range connections. Mm-hmm. They require certain high levels of connectivity. They have very fancy-looking geometries of how these codes are defined, which then you go back to the experimental people and say, okay, can you build a three-dimensional lattice of qubits in this hypergraph structure? And it's like, no, go away.
Yeah.
Well, two-dimensional where they just talk in a grid is difficult enough. Don't talk to me about
the usual
stuff.
The usual dichotomy between theorists and experimentalists who don't understand one another's life challenges very well.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly the people who work on the more esoteric error correction codes, they are required. They are no doubt required in the whole field to figure out better ways to do it as the technology gets better. But there's always this thing of what's reasonable to ask of the experimental community, especially when they have so many other challenges that they need to solve. They need to figure out how to manufacture en masse. They need to figure out how to build cheap qubits. You know, it doesn't do me any good if I require 10 million qubits and you can say, oh, I can build 10 million qubits, but they're going to cost $100 per qubit. Okay. A quantum computer is not now something that you could say is going to be a ubiquitous technology. It's going to be like the LHC, or it's going to be like LIGO. There's going to be a couple of them that we build around the world depending on the market for it. So I think the codes that we have now are certainly sufficient for the near term. They certainly perform the best. They are certainly good targets to try and hit for when you're talking about large-scale systems. And look, maybe a very, very smart theorist will come along. Mm. Or a smart student will come along and they'll figure out a much better way to do it.
Mm. You've mentioned a couple of times needing tens of millions of qubits to have a fault-tolerant full-scale device. How many qubits do you estimate will it take for a quantum computer to actually make significant revenue within the industry?
Well, that's a difficult question. If you're talking about revenue coming from outside sources who are interested in the computational capacity of the device, the 10 million qubit level, so what we know how to benchmark now very rigorously is Shor's algorithm. So Shor's algorithm requires 20 million qubits is the best estimates that we have. Now, in terms of market revenue, you've got a huge market revenue sitting there waiting for you if you can get to that scale. The most obvious thing to do is if you look at cryptocurrencies, especially Bitcoin, you've got a large amount of what people call dead wallets. So these are basically Bitcoins that people have lost the encryption keys for in their wallets, and so they're no longer traded on the market. They're effectively dead. One of the applications that you can use a quantum computer for is maybe the most famous example is breaking public key crypto. Wallets are generally secured using public key crypto keys. So you don't mine Bitcoin with quantum computers. You don't try to hack the Bitcoin network. What you do is you decrypt wallets. Mm. And in that point, you can say, well, there's a revenue stream for you there. If you've got 20 million qubits, you can go away and probably pull in, I don't know what the number is at the moment, maybe $500 trillion just from dead wallets in the entire Bitcoin network. Okay, there's a revenue stream. There's a target for you to hit. What happens below that? What can I do commercially with 10 million qubits or 1 million qubits? We don't actually know yet. Most of the applications that you talk about in the quantum simulation space or optimization space that people talk about, it could be related to climate change, it could be related to catalytics, it could be related to logistics. All of the numbers that we have so far, and there's a big caveat on this because we haven't worked on it as much as Shor's algorithm, lies above that number. So factoring actually happens first. And there's a huge market there for it, just in that particular aspect of it. Of course, there are other revenue streams you can get with factoring. At the moment, what everyone's trying to do is trying to make those applications that sit with qubit resource counts more than Shor's algorithm. We're trying to pull them down. We're trying to figure out better ways to do them, more efficient algorithms, more efficient ways of implementing the error correction in order for us to, okay, maybe we can do that with 1 million qubits or 500,000 qubits. And we're optimistic that that might be doable. But I can't point to anything at the moment that says, yes, we know how to do it.
So I want to change direction slightly. There's this expression called quantum hype, which has gained a lot of traction lately owing to significant exaggeration and misrepresentation of quantum technology in the media and in the press. And it's not to say that it's necessarily the fault of journalists. This is a highly nuanced field. If you're not a specialist, it's very easy to get the wrong impression of things.
Mm-hmm.
But based on the amount of quantum hype that's out there, the amount of exaggeration of what the capabilities of quantum computers are, the misrepresentation of what recent developments in the field are capable of. What would you be looking out for if you're an investor in the field? What would you see, without naming any names, as some of the red flags, some of the green flags of all of these emerging startups in the space, some of which are making very exaggerated claims?
Well, there's a lot of them. There's certainly, depending on the field, whether you're talking about quantum computing, software, communication, sensing, they differ. Depending on the specific claims of a company. There's certainly an aspect, let's sort of take them one by one, you sort of take it on the hardware front. A lot of the evolution of private sector investment into hardware has always been, we're not like the other guy. So the first major investments from the private sector into hardware could arguably said to be superconductors. So D-Wave was the first company and they're superconducting based. And then you had Google and IBM all get into the superconducting space. The next one after that was, generally speaking, was ion traps. Ion traps came in after superconductors. And a lot of the marketing from the companies was, well, superconductors need these big fridges to cool the superconductors down to 20,000th of a degree above absolute zero. We don't need that. So we're good. So this big thing that's going to cause them a problem is fine, we can scale to millions. Okay, that's true. They don't require them, but they require vacuums. And that's an infrastructure challenge in and of itself. After that came photonics. And photonics, well, we don't need the vacuums and we don't need the dilution refrigeration systems. In fact, we can work at room temperature. Okay, that's true to a large extent, except optics has the problem that all of its gates fail half the time. And so you've got to do so much work just to get a reliable gate interaction in photonics because even theoretically they fail 50% of the time. And now we're seeing diamond, we're seeing neutral atoms, we're seeing these other systems come in. And again, it's always, I'm not like the other guy. Instead of really coming and saying, okay, this is the nature of our system and here are the scaling challenges that we have. Now, that's not a red flag in terms of a company that might not be on the level, but it's certainly the history of how the VC evolution in this space has occurred. Now, what is starting to happen, and I'm thankful for this, is certainly within the community, even with the broader investment community, we're starting to see a little bit of calming down. It's like, this is not going to happen next year. And people are starting to realize it's not going to happen next year. And a lot of what we're seeing, if you look at the interaction between quantum companies and what we would call non-quantum corporates. So this is a definition I tend to use. It's a company who's interested in quantum but is not building quantum. So they're interested in it because it might be a benefit to them in the future. So a lot of sort of revenue to a lot of these companies would come in from non-quantum corporates interested to say, okay, we want to contract your company out to see how quantum is going to help us in vehicle manufacturing, if it's a General Motors or a BMW, or aeronautics, if it's Airbus or Boeing. A lot of that's now being replaced with government contracts. It's now being replaced with basically procurement. It was the way how digital technology evolved in the middle half of last century. A lot of it was the chips aren't very useful for much. So the companies who were building them, the companies who were developing, would get very, very large government contracts and basically the chips would be manufactured and be stuck in a drawer and nobody would do anything with them. I get the feeling that quantum's going to go in the same direction. A lot of it's going to be through national strategies. It's going to be government-sponsored. It's going to be big contracts to certain companies saying the French want to build a 100-qubit quantum computer or the Germans want to build a 200-qubit quantum computer. Here's a contract to do it. They might not work. They might not be effective for anything, but it's this sort of way that government has always used the procurement mechanism to keep an industry alive until it reaches a scale where they can generate their own customers and can be, to a certain extent, self-sufficient. And I really get the feeling that that's what we're going to see.
That's really interesting. So it seems like we're at the beginning of a boom cycle in the private sector in quantum tech. How would you currently evaluate the private sector landscape?
And are we going to have a big bust?
Yeah.
I mean, we are. To be honest, several conversations that I've had with people, there's a very good chance that we're going to see it in the next 12 months. Not a bust as in sector-wide, but certainly we're going to start seeing some failures. And, you know, it's complicated. It's got a lot to do with the VC community. It's got a lot to do with the general downturn. because of the war in Ukraine, especially if this winter happens to be a particularly bad winter in Europe, you're going to see capital markets start to constrict and you might see some of these companies go under. How that reverberates around the entire ecosystem, I don't know. We're still comparatively quite small. We are not a huge industry. It's not like the quantum startup space numbers in the thousands or tens of thousands of startups doing various things in quantum. Most of the time, it's about 100, 150 companies I think exist now. You know, as you know, being members of this community, you know a lot of the people. And any time somebody brings up this new company or this new group, you kind of know who they are and what they've done in the past. That's indicative of an industry that's small. So we've got four publicly traded quantum companies at the moment. We've got IonQ, Rigetti, D-Wave, and Quantum Computing Inc., which is a lesser-known company. There's a good chance that they might not survive in the next 12 to 18 months, and I don't know what happens if a couple of them go under. Does it cause a general contraction amongst everyone? Does it cause some of these national strategies to be rethought? At the moment, the national strategies worldwide are definitely propping up a lot of the enthusiasm, and certainly a lot of the private sector is looking at these national strategies as being funding mechanisms for them. If they start to constrict, then everything else starts to constrict, and then we possibly go into a winter or a bust cycle.
I mean, until very recently, this was a completely academically dominated field, and it's just in recent years that we've seen billions of dollars in private sector investment trickling into creating this startup space. Down the line, do you see the academic and private sectors as being complementary to one another, or do you see them being quite distinct or operating in unison in a cooperative manner? How do you see this unfolding?
Well, it's definitely going to be cooperative in the future. I mean, the private sector focuses on different things. The level of investment they require focuses on different things. It's one thing to build a 2-qubit or a 3-qubit system in the lab on the back of an ARC grant or some other funding mechanism that might be worth $500,000 or $1 million. It's a completely different thing to say, okay, we have to build the infrastructure where in the future we're pumping out chipsets, you know, by the dozens or millions potentially. That requires a whole different level of investment. And it's also a whole different level of focus. I mean, some of the more out there ideas or esoteric ideas that we have in the quantum information space that will undoubtedly help build a quantum computer in the future is not something that a company wants to invest time or money in. They don't want to do the highly speculative research. They're willing to do the work. If you're saying, okay, it's going to take 100 people, even on the theory side, it's going to take 100 people and 100 software engineers to build this software platform that allows me to do X. They're perfectly fine with investing in that. But they don't want this glaring hole in the middle saying, well, we don't actually know how to do this bit. You know, they want to understand how to get from A to B to C to the end. It might be a lot of software engineering to do it, but they want to know that there's an output there. And the academic sector is these black holes that sit around saying, okay, we need to make this better, or we need to figure out a different way of doing that. And that'll stay in the academic sector, I'm sure of it.
Mm. So there's many competing physical architectures for quantum computing, and right now it's not particularly clear who that winner is going to be. What do you see as the most likely candidate for winning the large-scale quantum computation race right now?
Yeah, it's too close to call right now.
Who are the biggest? Like, I know you said it's too close to call, but what immediately comes to mind? What technologies?
Well, there's the ones that are being the most heavily funded, and there's the ones I personally like. So the ones that are being the most heavily funded is undoubtedly superconductors. Just in terms of depth and breadth across a variety of companies. And they are certainly the ones with the largest number of qubits available. But there is significant limitations in how they're going to get pushed to the million to 10 million qubit level. The one I personally like, which is not as heavily invested in, is it's a broad category of qubits, but the quintessential example is Diamond. So I actually like Diamond. And it's a lot to do with the scaling infrastructure that's required. It's about, yes, they need to be cold, but they need to be 4 Kelvin. And 4 Kelvin is a lot easier to do than millikelvin temperatures. They don't require vacuums. They can be coupled with photons. They can talk to photons. And that's primarily the three the three qualities of an architecture that I like the most. Whether or not Diamond can actually do it, whether or not there's significant investment, whether or not there's material science questions that still need to be solved, I don't know. But those three elements of a quantum computing architecture, cold but not too cold, no vacuum systems, and ideally naturally able to couple to photons. If you can do those three things, I think you've got an architecture that's worthy of pursuing.
Having said all these things about scalability and error correction and the different types of architectures, if you could answer the million-dollar question and take a guess at how long you think it's going to be before we see large-scale, fault-tolerant quantum computing that can live up to the promise of implementing, being arbitrarily programmable, implement all of the promised algorithms, what type of timeline would you estimate for that?
Okay. I think 10 years if. 10 years if a given company finds it prudent to spend all their time and effort building one machine and not worry about where the second machine is going to come from and what it's going to cost. If a company sat down and said, okay, I want to hit a 20 million qubit machine to do factoring, scare the hell out of everyone and break Bitcoin wallets and say, that's my value proposition and I'm going to devote it. It's going to fit in 10 warehouses. It's going to look like a mess, but it's going to work. I reckon 10 years, you could maybe pull it off, maybe.
And if we wanted to extend that question to how long before we have a production line of consumer-ready devices?
A lot longer than that.
A lot longer.
A lot longer than that. If you're really going to, if you're going to have the question, is are quantum computers going to be ubiquitous or are they going to be LHC? And that's a question. At the moment, the industry works under the assumption, whether it's said explicitly or not, the industry works under the assumption that they're going to be ubiquitous. They're not working under the assumption that we're going to have five of them around the world. If you're working under the assumption of ubiquity, okay, there are major questions to solve, all related to infrastructure. Like a lot of quantum computing companies leverage themselves or leverage their value proposition, oh, we're CMOS compatible. We're compatible with the manufacturing process that is used to make chipsets in all your computers. And okay, some of these systems are more CMOS compatible with others. There are caveats to all of this. But the other question being is, okay, we've got a chip shortage at the moment, a classical chip shortage. Let's say a company tomorrow says, I've got it. I know exactly how to do it. I know exactly how to build this machine, but I need to leverage the tier one fabrication facilities worldwide to start doing this. The infrastructure that currently exists right now, are they going to say yes to that? Because we're in a chip shortage. They have to make more classical silicon. They know how to make more classical silicon. They know where the supply chaining for that is. They know where their markets are. Are they going to retask these things for the quantum person who comes in saying, oh, I've figured this out? Or is all this infrastructure going to have to be mirrored for the quantum industry, which means it has to be built, which means it has to be invested upon? So those kind of questions, if you're assuming ubiquity in quantum computers, is what's going to take a really long time.
Yeah, I guess from like a CMOS foundry perspective, one could make the assumption that because quantum computers have a fairly aligned with defense capabilities, that you could argue that the CMOS foundry stuff, you know, it depends from a customer base. Are you going to be building quantum computers for the general public or are you going to be building quantum computers for defense and industry? I would argue that if it's defense industry, you know, you just find the fabrication facilities.
It'll be found. They'll find a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
And that's possibly true. I mean, it depends. You know, if you said I could build a factoring machine tomorrow, there's at least one three-letter agency with the resources to say, okay, we'll build you a foundry. We'll build, if you know how to do this, we will put the money up and build you a foundry in 18 months. There's at least one three-letter agency that could probably do that.
Yeah.
On a slightly different note, you have significant experience with the private sector yourself. You run a consultant company called HBAR. Tell us about what HBAR does and what you do there.
Yeah, so we started, me and Jared Cole from RMIT, we started HBAR in late 2015, early 2016. And a lot of it was about providing services, especially to the due diligence part of investment. So especially back in that time, investors were interested in quantum, but very little information existed about what this was, how to assess certain groups, et cetera. So that's where we got started. It was providing services to VC firms when they were looking to invest in hardware or software companies, and basically being a filter for them, saying, okay, these people are well-known, they know what they're doing, or I've never heard of these people before, which means there's something wrong. Because, again, the community's small enough that we know who they are, or we should know who they are. HBAR's sort of evolved over the years depending on what the market requires. So VC due diligence is not a huge part of what we do anymore, because a lot of other consultancies, a lot of other outfits now exist to sort of compete with us. But it ebbs and flows. So we've done IP assessments for universities. We've done strategic consulting for governments, corporates and startups in regards to their strategies. We've been doing things recently as banal as understanding how education works within the framework of national strategies. So how do I fold in either training programs like the SQA or like what happens here at the Quantum Terminal, or even more basic things like, do we need to start thinking about how education needs to be folded into high school? Do we need to rethink how we're teaching physics? Do we need to rethink how we're teaching computer science? So HBAR does what we call short-term contracts. So we don't do sponsored research or anything like that. It's very, you know, here's what we want done. It's going to take a couple of weeks to get it done, and we'll provide the expertise and services for it. Yeah. But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, so when you engage investors, well, when investors engage you, rather, at what stage in that process are they engaging you? You said for due diligence. Do they engage you at the part where they're kind of certain about the technology that they want to invest in and they're just kind of making sure, or are they asking you kind of, okay, from blank slate, tell us yes or no, should we invest in these guys?
Well, it's been varied. We've come in at the due diligence process at different stages. It's usually very early stage VC investment, but some of it has come, you know, I've met this guy at a pub or a conference or something. He's got a startup looking at doing X. Do you know him? Do you know this technology, et cetera, et cetera? All the way through to, okay, we're about ready to sign a term sheet. We need to assess the technical aspects of their deck. So we only do technical due diligence. We don't do business due diligence. We need to assess what they're telling us. Mm. Is what they're telling us realistic, given what you know about their technology, given what you know about them, and given what you know about the ecosystem at large?
Yeah, something I'm interested in. So I'd imagine often you kind of have to break bad news to investors. You know, you've been asked to assess a technology, and you obviously have quite strong opinions on mm-hmm. on a lot of technologies. How is that usually received by the investors?
Oh, by the investors. I mean, the way I speak on something like this is a lot different to the way that I would speak to an investor when we talk about certain technologies. But they usually want a detailed report. Like if we do an assessment on a company, it's not just sitting down with the investor on a phone call and saying, you know, I think this is good or I think this is not good. It's generally I have to write a very detailed report, and it's very much like an academic paper in that. So I have to justify it. I have to say, okay, they've said X. Whether I agree with it or don't agree with it, I have to say they've said X. I believe this is true, not true, realistic, not realistic, and this is why, you know. This is what company Y has done. This is what they've invested. This is the time it's taken. You know, for example, if a company comes to me or comes to an investor and says, well, we're going to work on, I don't know, anionic quantum computing. We're going to compete with Microsoft and we're going to have a fully fault tolerant system by 2025. Okay. So you go back, you don't just say, no, they're full of it. You go back and say, well, look, Microsoft has invested this amount of money, but they've had these people associated with them, and it's taken them God knows how many years even get to the stage where they might have possibly seen the signatures of this thing that they're supposed to build a quantum computer out of. So when a company tells you, well, they're going to build a fully scalable system in 3 years, that's why they're wrong. And that's never a very contentious discussion at all. And some of the times, you know, investors will come back and say, okay, we've got your report. We're going to show your report to the company and say that this is what HBAR has said about this. And, you know, I'm sure that has made some people happy, made some people not so happy to see what I've written, but it's always completely open.
Mm-hmm.
And they get the right to reply. You know, they say, HBAR said this. Do you have any response to this? And they're always given the opportunity.
I guess that's another part of the coin. How do you go about breaking bad news to the companies themselves that you maybe all the technologies?
We don't do that. So, no, we don't have the responsibility of telling the companies what our direct thoughts are. It always goes through the investor.
All right.
But we work for the investor.
Yeah.
You know, we're hired by the investor. We're paid by the investor to do this. We don't work for the company.
Mm.
So the company can tell us whatever they want. It's our job to figure out whether or not what they're saying is reasonable. And in some cases, you get companies that are just saying things that are off the wall. Those kind of reports are a lot easier to write than a company who is legitimate and they come from a legitimately good background in terms of their research, but just might be pushing things a bit too much.
Using some quantum hype.
Yeah, a little bit. And it does. It is also about tamping down expectations, because I think you get a lot of founders also get caught up with the, I have to sell it the best way I can. And I think that can get them into trouble later, because it's like, well, I've sold you on this proposition that I'm going to do X by year Y. I'm not going to be able to do it. And it's the investor will often likely invest in you if you just pull it back a little bit and say, okay, I'm not going to build 30 million qubits in 18 months. I'll build 30. Investors, a lot of the time, it's like, that's fine. I can live with that if they've got a roadmap beyond that.
We've discussed quantum computing up until now. I guess one of the other big quantum tech fields is quantum communication. Can you tell us a bit about what you see as the future in quantum communication? What are the use cases there? Because I know you've done a lot of research on this. What are the use cases for quantum communication? Do you think it's realistic that we're going to see global quantum communication networks the way we do with the current classical internet? And what do you see as the most interesting applications for such a network, should it exist?
Yeah, you've set me up with this because you know what I work on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, in the quantum communication space, I'm not a big fan of the way it's currently done. Quantum satellites, I don't believe, have the capability to move beyond key distribution as an application. And certainly key distribution is a, you know, it's a great application. It's certainly motivated a lot of experimental and hardware development. But especially if you think in the space case, is it worth the money to do space-based quantum key distribution, potentially globally, which satellites can't do right now? And even the theoretical analysis suggests you could possibly do it, but the key rates are going to be pretty low and not going to be able to service that much.
I mean, for context, the one put up, the very famous one initially put up by China, which must have cost on the order of hundreds of millions, I imagine, that ended up having a key rate on the order of hertz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've heard some other numbers from, it's not as sophisticated as the Chinese satellite, these other sort of smaller payload satellites that they don't distribute entangled photons, they just do bullet single photons to the ground. And I've heard some numbers suggesting that one of them, I think it was in orbit for a year or two, and it managed to generate about 500 kilobytes worth of key material, which is not much to service a QKD commercial market. Might be very, very good for certain governments when they're the only user, they're the only customer. But if you're wanting to think about, well, what does quantum communications look like as you scale, as you go to what you would call a quantum internet, I'm not sure that these platforms are necessarily going to work.
So it has scalability issues of its own, which sound like they're just as severe or perhaps more severe than the stone walls that are facing quantum computing at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, to a certain extent, it's harder. I mean, if you're talking about QKD networks, okay, that has applicability, that has a certain level of market share. Whether it's justified with the cost of the technology right now is a different discussion. But a lot of what I see happening is that QKD is often intertwined with the quantum internet. Now, that's a different beast, what that thing is, as you know from your own work. The quantum internet is a fundamentally, quantitatively, qualitatively different thing than a key distribution network.
Yeah.
If you're talking about interconnected quantum computers globally scaled, that requires much, much different technology to use. Certainly, some of my own research work where we're harkening back to this old idea of sneak nets, you know, the idea where you load information onto a hard drive and you physically FedEx it around, which is done classically. Amazon does it. Hollywood does it. Netflix does it. But you only do it for applications where you don't need real-time communications.
Yeah.
The quantum version of Sneakonit gets around this because you're shipping entanglement, as you know.
And doesn't have latency issues.
Doesn't have latency issues. You can use it. And one of the things that I'm working on right now that I find very interesting, just from a more foundational point of view with communications, is if you look at the history of communications over the course of human history, there has always been this dynamical trade-off between latency and bandwidth. So the great example I usually give is signal fires versus courier on a horseback. So a signal fire, you know, I'm sure everyone's seen it in movies, is where you position this big bonfire. Usually the first one sits on the coastline. And then you put one on the hilltop within line of sight from this mountain to the next mountain to the next mountain to the next mountain. So take the English, for example. You might have a signal fire that sits on the cliffs of Dover. And then you go from hilltop to hilltop to hilltop until you get to London. It's got ultra-low latency, let's put it that way, because it's speed of light between the mountaintops and then it's the speed required for a guy to set a fire once he sees one coming.
Yeah.
But it allows you to transmit one bit of information. And the way it works is while the bit is zero, i.e. there's no fire, everything's good. Once the bit flips to a one, it's, oh, my God, the Spanish are coming.
Mm.
And that's the quintessential example, low latency, low bandwidth. The guy on the horseback who might be able to carry three or four books worth of information, well, that's got higher bandwidth, but it's got higher latency because he's got a ride from Dover to London, which might take him a day, take him 2 days. And if you go through the history of communications development, you know, you start looking at technologies that were adopted and then discarded, it's all been this game. So another example, you move into the 20th century when we start launching satellites. Well, we start launching satellites because that gives us greater global coverage at good bandwidths, especially if we had geosatellites, satellites in geosynchronous orbit. We could cover half the planet, bounce a signal off a satellite, you get from one half of the planet to the other. But now you're talking about, well, if we have looking at the digital age, it's got low latency. Well, sorry, high latency. You know, the signal's got to travel the 36,000 kilometers up to the satellite and back down again. Even at the speed of light, that takes time. So then we go to fiber optics. So fiber optics is, again, hardware infrastructure, but it's faster. Now you look at Starlink with SpaceX. Well, what are they trying to get away with there? It's because the speed of light in a fiber is not quite as fast as the speed of light in free space. It's diminished by 5 or 6% in fiber. Now, we can't go to geosatellites because that will increase our latency. So what SpaceX has done is said, we'll go to satellites, but we're going to stick them at 500 kilometers above the surface of the Earth, and we're going to put 40,000 of them there to cover the whole Earth. Because we don't want the signal to travel long distance and therefore take time, we can get higher bandwidths and higher speed because we're not transmitting it through fiber, but the cost is going to be deploying 30,000 or 40,000 satellites into orbit. So there's always this trade-off.
Yeah.
One of the really interesting things about quantum that I think is possible is being able to detach this. And we haven't figured this out fully. Hopefully we will, and we'll be able to put something, you know, publish something soon on this. But the idea of, can you decouple bandwidth and latency for a quantum internet? Now, that opens up some very interesting questions, maybe not in terms of how the technology will mature over the next 20 or 30 years, but how the technology might mature over the next 2 or 3 centuries.
Yeah.
Because if you come up with a communication systems where you're no longer trading bandwidth for latency and going back and forth all the time, that you can decouple these two things completely, I think that's has the potential of really revolutionizing.
And the ability to everything. Do that is something that's very unique to quantum communication that doesn't have a classical analog.
Yeah.
As you say, the idea of a sneaker net, a truck full of CDs, you can never use that for even a telephone call, even though it has the bandwidth for a million movies at once. But with entanglement distribution, that's a different consideration altogether.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I've spoken to you, Peter, about in private, what happens when entanglement becomes a commodity?
Yeah.
What happens when it's traded or sold or bought like electricity?
Mm.
And we've got a market that, you know, we're sitting here in a room. We're obviously utilizing electricity. We're getting it from somewhere. We don't know how we're getting it. We don't know the electrons that's passing through this microphone at the moment. We don't know if it's we were initially generated through coal or through solar or through wind. There's just this stuff.
It's that just we a call utility. That's
it's a
there.
Utility.
Yeah.
That's generated one way. What happens in terms of information processing, communications, just general technology development, when we see entanglement as being like electricity and being commodified in that way, being bought, sold, traded, utilized for all kinds of applications, that's where I really feel the really interesting conversations are. Certainly what's being done now in the private sector space with all these startups, sure, they're trying to build it. And there's a huge gap before where the technology is now to where it needs to be before you start playing some of these games. But once you start playing some of these games, it's just going to amplify. You're just going to go from some of these games to a lot of these games to fundamentally transforming how we do stuff.
Simon, it's been a fantastic conversation. Thank you very much for joining us.
Do you have anything you want to plug? Events that you're running or?
I will mention that we just launched the Australian Quantum Software Network last week. So quantumsoftware.org.au if people want to see what's happening Australia-wide when it comes to quantum software and theory development.
Great.
Awesome. Yes, I'd like to make a mention of our sponsors, The Quantum Terminal. Please discover more by visiting thequantumterminal.com or book a tour through hello.tqt@thequantumterminal.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn at The Quantum Terminal.